All right, today on the It's Going Down podcast, we are joined with George Chicarello Marr. He is the author of the brand new book, Decolonizing Dialectics. We cover a lot of ground today. We start off talking about the trials and tribulations that's been happening with George at his work where he teaches, also his interactions with the mainstream media and the various Twitter controversies that he's been engulfed in the last several months. We then switch gears and talk about the Trump regime. We talk about Sheriff Clark. We talk about Joe Lieberman. And we talk about the possibilities that are open with mass disaffection of not only Trump and the Republican Party, but also Democratic politics as usual, and also mass rejection of the recent health care bill, among other things. Thanks a lot for George for coming on. And remember, we have a brand new Patreon campaign that we just launched. We're climbing up to the $3,000 mark. Thanks to everybody that's donated. Every little bit helps. Please help us grow. Help us continue. Let's get to it. No, okay, we're joined here today with George Chicarello Marr. George, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
So we're going to be talking about a lot of different stuff, what's going on with you. You have a situation going on where you work. We're going to be talking about that. You've been in the news recently. We're going to cover some of that ground. We're just going to pick your brain, too, about everything that's been going on with Trump, the new health care plan that the Republicans have proposed, Sheriff Clark and Joseph Lieberman looking like they're going to be coming into the Trump administration. A lot of these kind of big picture issues. But let's just get started. One thing I want to start off the conversation is talking about, you were recently on Tucker Carlson talking about some of these same things. And just, I'm really curious what that experience is like, because every time I've seen that show or like been in like a diner and it's playing somewhere in the background, Tucker Carlson just looks like he's constipated and he's like looking at the last line of the eye chart, and he's like squinting and he's got the bow tie on. It just seems kind of ridiculous. But what was that like being on that show?
Yeah, I mean, it was high key absurd, to be, you know, to be completely honest. I think, you know, I don't think anyone ever goes on a show like that thinking that they're going to convince your average Tucker viewer or convince Tucker, you know.
Right.
And you go on there to be sort of like mildly abused, but also to like push things in certain directions that may be strategic. But I think what I was less prepared for was just how absurd, you know, it got, you know, when he's picking out, you know, passages that he claims are totally hard to understand, but these are passages that were actually written for like a popular journal 10 years ago about Venezuela. And they're pretty clear for anyone who's paying attention and trying to. But, you know, the whole shtick of like, I don't understand what intellectuals are saying really plays, I think, to this base, which is not, you know, not a base that's interested in reflecting on much of anything.
Right. And we're going to talk a little bit about kind of like what happens to that base. Now that Trump is saying things like Islam is a, you know, one of the great faiths, people are very upset about that. So we're going to talk a little bit about that later. But when they got at you about this, did they try to sell it to you, or like you can come on the show and say whatever you want or get your side of the story out, or how did they kind of approach you?
No. I mean, I knew that they were going to, you know, that they were going to sort of sabotage me and, you know, and ambush me in whatever way possible. They actually told me that it was going to be only about, you know, about the question of I was invited technically to talk about Charles Murray, who was speaking nearby Philadelphia at Villanova. And they invited me on because I was one of the people, I think, standing up and saying against this kind of free speech absolutism on the left that says, no, we just have to stand up for free speech. You know, I was the one saying, no, we don't have to stand up for the free speech of eugenicists, racists and bigots to speak. And certainly not the privilege to have a, you know, access to a platform on campus to, you know, to spout, you know, their kind of hatred. And so I had urged people to shut down Charles Murray. And there was a successful protest against Charles Murray. So they brought me on about that. Of course, though, they wanted to, you know, use whatever they could, you know, to try to ambush me and to, you know, to try to make me look ridiculous. And of course, the funny thing about these shows, and this is not a surprise, is that, you know, is that our people, you know, thought that he looked ridiculous. And his people, of course, thought that I looked ridiculous because this is how they work. And this is a fundamental question, a political question, a cultural question about how Fox News functions and what kind of a base it's mobilizing and whipping up and pushing into action, right? Because, you know, this is in a period during which I was getting thousands of emails from basically like Fox News viewers threatening me, you know, attacking me and urging that I be fired from my job as well.
Do you feel that there is a way to crack through that? Because I think you bring up a very real dilemma. It's like, it feels like you can't really argue with facts or, you know, capital T truth or something like that. But how do you have a conversation then with a big part of the population that, you know, class-wise may actually be on your side, so to speak, but like politically is just like totally batshit crazy.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that conversation is really kind of one of the urgent tasks of the present. You know, Tucker Carlson Show is not the prime, locus for us to have that conversation because
sure.
It's not
right.
It's not a, any kind of neutral terrain. And I think one of the questions raised by the Trump election is how it is that the left can be better at reaching out, not to sort of embrace the reactionary politics of the average Trump voter, but to provide alternative explanations for the existential conditions of those voters, right? The Democrats don't know how to speak to a poor white person and say, this is what is why your life sucks so bad, right? Because they're the ones who created that condition, right? They're the ones who benefit from that condition. And Trump uses a sort of crass, you know, mendacious populism to try to speak to that. And the only person on the left, of course, was Bernie, who was in some ways actually able to dig into that base a little bit and point toward the real questions. But what the left needs to be able to do is to speak in a language that provides these alternatives, because the center is collapsing in the United States, in Europe. You see the rise on the one hand of right wing sort of populism and fascisms, and you see the potential of left-wing populisms and radical movements that can emerge out of that same context if we can speak a language that provides people a sort of channel, to move from right-wing politics toward left-wing politics.
Now, when you say language, what do you mean? Like there has to be certain code words? Because, I mean, a lot of what Trump is doing is, like, playing up, stuff that maybe you might hear on, like, InfoWars or something like that, and then he says it, and you're like, oh, yeah, okay. But, I mean, do you mean, like, a specific language or just, like, getting beyond kind of like weird activist, like mumbo jumbo lingo?
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of it. So on the one hand, there's a question of arguments, right? Actually putting forward good arguments that will help explain, right? You are not poor because of black and brown people. You are not poor because of migrants taking your jobs. You're actually poor because capitalism is fucking you, you know, systemically. Mm-hmm. And providing an analysis that allows people to grasp maybe why that is true. But at the same time, I think we need to understand that people don't, you know, it's not only a question of reasoning and rationality. People don't, you know, sign up for white supremacy because they think it's rational. They sign up because it makes them feel good. They sign up because it's a kind of affect. And they sign up, because they want to ensconce themselves in the irrational. So we need to do kind of both things at once, which is to provide this argument, but then also provide access and a kind of cultural opening for people to, you know, to think differently and to move in a different direction. And I think that does involve, on the one hand, left-wing culture, you know, the sort of cliquish, you know, language that we use on the left, but also the fact that, I mean, it's no lie when the Republicans or when Trump in particular say that the Democrats are detached urban elites who don't understand anything about rural America and about poor America, and that's true. And so I think we need to understand that as well and attempt to, you know, to create the kind of cultural terrain that will allow for these questions to be raised.
Yeah, I totally agree. Well, just to go back to the situation where you teach at, can you just describe for people exactly what's going on? There's been several tweet storms that have gone up. I mean, the most notable one has been this. You made a joke about white genocide, and you responded to this by saying, like, you know, white genocide is a white supremacist, you know, hashtag, and, like, I was making fun of it, and there was a lot of pushback for this. But can you just describe, I know you recently said that you're officially under investigation by the university where you teach at?
Yeah, so, I mean, essentially what's happened, and we need to understand this in its historical context, right? We're talking about the moment this begins, the moment after Trump's elected, before he comes to power, the moment in which, and I know we'll talk about this later, in which this kind of very tense and fraught coalition that Trump cobbles together, including the far alt-right, you know, white supremacists, you know, is holding together. And so you've got these openly Nazi, fascistic, anti-Semitic groups believing that they're on the cusp of power, right? And they've got Bannon in the White House. They've got access to the sort of the halls of power. And so they're feeling, you know, they're feeling like they're on the, you know, on the path to victory. And that's part of why they reacted so strongly when I tweeted about one of their kind of most sacred myths, which is the idea that, you know, that white people are sort of slowly being genocided. And by that, just to be clear, what they mean is not killed and slaughtered, but what they mean is sort of bred out. What they mean is destroyed by intermarriage. The sort of essential, you know, potency of the white race is being sapped, and multicultural politics is part of what's behind this. And this is, of course, an absurd idea, but it dovetails also with a much more mainstream idea. And this is where you see, I think, the mainstream implications of what the alt-right has been doing, because white genocide, what, you know, what the far, far right calls white genocide, translates directly into what the mainstream right and even, you know, many in the center understand is this sort of white victim narrative that maybe once, you know, other people were victims, but now white people, because of affirmative action and everything else, we're the real victims, you know, everything's against us. And this is a narrative that has been deeply sown over the past series of decades, so that it really plays into this question of the Trump presidency, you know, this sort of, in other words, this kind of, you know, whitewashed white supremacist narrative actually has, you know, a kind of mainstream appeal that's crucial.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, like, for instance, take a group like the Oath Keepers. They, like, their policy is like, we're not white nationalists, we're against all identity politics. But still, like, they go back to this thing where, you know, white men are under attack. You know, we're the ones that are getting most attacked in society. And it's funny that people reject this kind of like identity politics, you know, regardless of where it comes from, but then they, like, their baseline of understanding of who they are in the world is like this weird form of reactionary identity politics.
Absolutely. And Richard Spencer is the one that's honest about that, right?
Right.
And when he talks about identity politics for white people, he actually, despite being a totally unimpressive person in general, he actually gets some things. And that's part of why he's been able to reach out in a certain way to certain sectors, because he admits, right? That, you know, that he's using things that he associates with the left. But instead of, for example, denouncing cultural appropriation in the, you know, or denouncing the liberal anxiety over cultural appropriation, he instead kind of takes that up and makes it part of his own arsenal. So I think, you know, this is the historical context of what's been going on. And as a result of this, I became a target, and I was harassed systematically. My workplace was harassed and threatened, and universities don't know how to deal with this yet. It's a relatively new phenomenon. When they get 1,000 emails over the course of a couple of days,
right?
The assumption is that there's something real there, as opposed to some kind of manufactured, controversy. And the university reacted initially in a really damaging way by denouncing me. And the next day, the Daily Stormer, which is an anti-Semitic, you know, white supremacist website, celebrated. They said we won, right? This was a victory for us because we forced a university to react. And that was really the weather balloon they were sending up, which is that they want to be able to intervene on campus. They want to be able to force university administrations to fire people. And this is a new aggressive campaign that the far right is launching on campus. It involves recording faculty. It involves threatening and harassing faculty, using a victim narrative constantly, as in a totally disingenuous way to make it sound as though faculty are discriminatory toward these students, and doing this all as part of a big cultural push onto the campuses.
How do you feel? I mean, we look at this idea of free speech. I mean, the far right is now, especially like with Kyle Chapman, aka Base Stick Man, is like organizing all these kind of free speech rallies, which is really kind of a collection of militia types, Trump supporters, and some of the alt-right. But they're really rallying around this thing of free speech. But obviously, with your situation, I mean, would you argue that this is free speech in itself being under attack? I mean, like, how do those two narratives kind of play, like, slam together in reality, would you say?
I think it's especially because the far right is using this language of free speech as a kind of wedge to open up struggles on campus that we need to be as precise as possible in the way that we understand things. And I already said, you know, I'm against free speech absolutism. There are some very, very loud and annoying voices on the left that only see things in terms of free speech. And that, I think, is not a way to build any kind of left-wing politics, because then you find yourself defending, for example, the so-called right of Milo Yiannopoulos to unleash, you know, transphobic and racist harassment against people on campus. And that is not a left-wing politics. You know, that's not something that we can defend. And then when you look at cases, if you look like my case, for example, you need to be attentive to the fact that this has something to do with free speech, but is not fundamentally about free speech, right? Mm-hmm. It's about right-wing aggression against campus that involves questions of free speech. It also involves questions of academic freedom, which is a slightly different idea that allows me to sort of engage in on and off campus in certain ways. And it also, you know, involves the questions of the substance of what is actually happening. In other words, I think it's important to defend academic freedom, and it's important to defend academic speech. But if I had a colleague who was like espousing Nazism on campus, of course, the substance of those statements and the active threat that those statements pose to students on campus and others really raises difficult questions. And so you can never think about these things in terms of these kind of abstract formal rules. And I actually think that it's a cop-out, right? People that only talk about free speech, like, you know, the Bill Maher's of the world, who claim that any speech is fine and good speech defeats bad. I think it's just people trying to find an easy rule and an easy category to use to make decisions for them, because they don't want to have to make hard decisions for themselves. When we're actually fighting a battle, and for that battle, we need to use weapons, and we need to fight against the enemies that we have.
Yeah, I find it interesting that a lot of liberals have this thing where they're like, well, I'm pro free speech, but hate speech is not free speech. And our thing has always been like, there's censorship and then there's speech, and we're against state censorship of anybody, because ultimately that's going to come back on us. But as a community, we should organize and respond to a fascist movement, regardless of if they're giving a talk or they're handing out flyers or putting up stickers.
Absolutely. And that's the fundamental question, right? So it was not the state that shut down Milo Yiannopoulos. It was people organizing in the streets who said enough is enough. Fuck this. We are not going to accept this. And that's free speech, right? Like, that is an expression of
exactly,
free speech.
Yeah.
And then you have groups, you know, you have the right also using this idea, but also the ACLU endorsing this idea of the so-called heckler's veto, which means essentially, I guess, you can have free speech, but if it's too loud or too sort of rowdy, then it becomes an infringement on speech. But at no point, for example, in the First Amendment, doesn't say the speech can't be rowdy. I mean, and it's, you know, historically the most important kinds of speech have always been rowdy and disruptive and mobilizing and organizing and disrupting. This is all part of, you know, of speech.
Right.
And speech is never separate from action. So, you know, Charles Murray, in his, you know, a powerfully dangerous book, The Bell Curve, which was directly implicated in things like mass incarceration and police violence, and also Richard Spencer, who, of course, calls for peaceful ethnic cleansing. These are people who use speech to engage in violence and to justify violence and legitimize right-wing reactionary violence.
Yeah, so I find it interesting. I saw a really funny picture from when Ann Coulter was supposed to come on the UC Berkeley campus, and it had a list that the UC Berkeley police had put up of all the things that were banned in Sproul Plaza, which is a major plaza on the campus. And it said, like, you know, guns, you know, explosives, like illegal drugs. And then, like, in the middle of the list was banners and signs. And it was interesting that no one really flipped out about that. You know, the police were stopping anybody from protesting with banners and signs on the campus. But, you know, people were somehow upset that, like, groups with, you know, lots of money, like YAF, Young Americans for Freedom, which is a huge foundation that gives money to people like Coulter to come speak, you know, pulled out. And then when Coulter saw in Berkeley that there was no money to be had, she's like, oh, fuck it, I'm done.
Exactly. And this points precisely toward what has always been the case with these kind of, you know, feigned sort of and cultivated and, you know, manufactured controversies over free speech, is that speech is really always about money, and it's always about access, and it's never been free. It's never been universally accessible. You know, the First Amendment means that you can stand on the street corner and yell, but it gives no one access to privileged spaces and audiences. And what gives them that access is a profoundly unequal and uneven system of authority. And And so I think we make a mistake from the beginning when we assume that speech is and has been free instead of being a sort of terrain for hegemonic struggle.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a George Lincoln Rockwell, which is the leader of the American Nazi Party. He had a famous quote. He said, there's free speech only for the rich. And it's interesting that when we talk about all this stuff, it seems like really what the right is saying, like, free speech means that the state protects me from going out and engaging in speech or organizing. That's what free speech means to them, that the state uses its violence to protect us whenever we go out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Against people trying to shut them down.
Yeah, and for the most part, they know what they're doing because they know they need that protection to be able to build their movements. And that's why Richard Spencer getting clocked was was a hugely important moment, right? Because he went off and cowered and admitted that he went to what he called a safe space, completely oblivious, I think, to the irony of that statement. And, you know, and talked about feeling threatened and not being able to organize in public. And so when they went out and burned torches in, you know, in the South, they had to do so in secret, right? They, you know, and so they know that they need the sort of air provided by a mealy-mouthed liberalism that won't shut down their speech and that will protect them. And the ACLU protecting the rights of Nazis to speak, they need that to grow their Nazi movements, because if it weren't for that, that space, then they would disappear relatively quickly.
Well, you brought up Richard Spencer. I was talking with somebody the other day that said something very interesting, and they said the way that the alt-right views class says a lot about how they view race and gender. And there was recently a meme that we shared that somebody from their side had made, but it showed like five different Nazi groups, and they were all cogs on a wheel. I don't know if you saw this on Twitter. But basically it had like groups at the bottom that were more classically neo-Nazi and a group like Identity Europa on the top, and they had a class breakdown, and they said lower class, middle class, upper class, and Identity Europa was at the top. And I'm just curious, like, to me it seems bizarre that Richard Spencer can say that like there's a spirit or a culture that unites all white people, being that, you know, his parents have massive amounts of money, he gets millions of dollars from a cotton farm. How do you think that theoretically they can even make this argument that there could be something that could unite all these different people, you know, from different class backgrounds?
Well,
but then go on to say that, you know, people that could work in the same job of different races are different.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a construct, right? They try to invent an idea that will help unify. And I mean, this whole idea and Identity Europa is really funny, interesting too, as well, because it's like, not only is it like whiteness, it's claiming Europeanness, as though there were anything that unified, people of European heritage, like any cultural unity, right? And then you get to the category of white, which of course is so important in the history of the U.S. as something which emerges and is invented at a certain period of time to denote kind of the most empty, you know, identity you could possibly point toward, you know, one that rests purely on a package of privileges and authority, and means nothing beyond that. And this is especially visible in the fact that certain groups are not part of the white club and then are, you know, are promoted to being part of the white club at certain points in history based on their willingness to embrace certain political positions and embrace their own superiority. So this is all constructed, right? This is all, you know, this is all a myth that they have to create in order to build that unity, but it's also been the most dangerous and pernicious and effective myth in U.S. history. If you look at Black Reconstruction by Du Bois about the Civil War and about Reconstruction as this moment of dramatic potential for class unity between, in other words, recently freed slaves, the black poor, the black workers, and the white poor in the South, and the tragedy of white, you know, poor Southerners selling out themselves and selling out their own class interests to embrace the petty privileges of a cross-class unity with the former slave owners, with the wealthy. And this is really the, you know, the devil's bargain of, you know, of whiteness, which is it's what in U.S. history helps to destroy any potential for class unity. And it's really, frankly, the key question that needs to be struggled with in the present as well.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with you there. Looking at the South with, you know, there are hundreds and hundreds of contested Confederate monuments, and it looks like over the summer this will continue to be something we're going to see again and again, you know, people on the right gravitating towards protecting them and then people calling for their removal or even, you know, I know, standing there to make sure that they are removed, because I know some of the statues are scheduled to be removed. But just in terms of history, how do you feel like we can actually get that across to people? Because I feel like there's a real desire by a lot of people, like, oh, we don't want to go back. We don't want to talk about, you know, what happened. We just want to, like, hold on to something. You know, it's like a holding on to history, but then also not wanting to go back and, like, face it. And that's actually one of the reasons I really like the Free State of Jones film, because at least, you know, it's something that people can watch and, you know, understand that, you know, this history, there is a history of people coming together across racial lines and fighting back. But I'm just curious if you had any thoughts about as we see these kind of struggles play out.
Yeah, I think it's in some ways the replay of the question of the Confederate flag that we saw a couple of years ago. And I think my view is always that it's better, infinitely better, for people to tear that shit down by themselves. You know, it's definitely better for people to tear down these statues by themselves and hack them to pieces and melt them down than it is to ask the state to do that. Right. But there is nevertheless some kind of political content in demanding that states do that. I think we just lose some of our power and our autonomy in the course of that. If that's our sort of, you know, our only alternative is to lean on the state as a sort of protector against, you know, against the reactionaries. But what's important, and what's even more important, I think, is what these struggles point toward and what they unleash, and, you know, what kind of, you know, the ability to bury this history in a way that will be productive, right? Not to not talk about it, but actually to talk about the ways in which that history is the present, right? You had this Mississippi lawmaker saying that people who want to tear the statues down should be lynched, right? You know, so the past is very clearly you know, the present as well. I mean, in the broad arc of U.S. history is precisely that forms of containment of, you know, of the black population are replaced by other forms. You know, it's not that things move forward, strictly speaking. It's that slavery is replaced by Jim Crow, is replaced by mass incarceration and policing. And this points precisely toward a white anxiety that requires these other systems to enter into force and to be in place. And every time black Americans win struggles, whether it be for emancipation or for civil rights, the reaction against that leads us precisely in some ways to where we are today, namely this whole idea that white people, as a result of civil rights, in other words, equality for black Americans, white people are somehow now considering themselves to be victims.
Right. Well, let's switch gears just a little bit. So Sheriff Clark is going to take a position within Homeland Security. And also there seems to be talk of Joseph Lieberman coming in to possibly retake or take over Comey's position as head of the FBI. Any thoughts on, I mean, this kind of segues right into what you were talking about, but any thoughts on these people coming in to have, I mean, pretty disgusting histories, obviously. And Sheriff Clark, not only having connections to like the Oath Keepers, but, you know, saying that, you know, Black Lives Matter is a terrorist group and, you know, needs to be wiped off the map, essentially.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there are different cases for different reasons. In the case of Lieberman, I think on the one hand, what makes it so dangerous is precisely the fact that he positions himself as a sort of bipartisan, you know, candidate, when he's actually just the most utterly reactionary person. And particularly when it comes to, you know, his kind of brutal attacks on like WikiLeaks and on all kind of, you know, whistleblowers, meaning that as a head of the FBI, he'll be able to, you know, do the Trump administration's bidding when it comes to investigating people who are releasing any kind of information or, you know, or really, you know, upping the information warfare game against our movements in general. I think that's something we need to be very aware of. Just the, you know, simply the fact that he used to be a Democrat shouldn't conceal, you know, the fact that he's actually in some ways more, many ways more reactionary than people like, you know, like Comey and others who are actually kind of, you know, administratively, you know, predictable people. I mean, and Sheriff Clark, of course, points toward this really bizarre sort of, you know, black face for really brutally fascist movements. And this then raises a very different question, which is this question of the white supremacist right, of the ways that it's it exists only because of its strategy of kind of whitewashing, neutralizing it, sort of, you know, not calling itself Nazi, not calling itself whatever else, and creating a narrative that can be injected into mainstream discourse so that even now you see Democrats and others embracing elements of, you know, the Trump presidency and you know, sanitizing what's been going on, really sanitizing this brutal reality that we've been living through.
Right. Well, let's turn now to the AHCA, or the American Healthcare Act. Just your thoughts on it. I mean, we've seen now over the past couple of weeks just really heated town halls, people stuffing money down different speaker shirts and stuff like that because they're just so angry. What do you think that anti-capitalists and revolutionaries should be thinking about as we see these events play out? What should be in our heads right now?
I mean, I would say two things, and it has to do with, on one hand, the Republicans, but also in particular Trump, and on the other hand, the Democrats. I think when we talk about, you know, right-wing populism being a fundamentally dishonest populism, I think this is a good example of that, right? You know, and this is the whole case of, you know, of the sort of the Trump voters who thought they were voting for something else, allegedly, you know, and being really just shocked to find out that this is going to affect them and impact them in radically negative ways, and that they're responding to that material reality with an uncontainable outrage. And it then points as well toward the utter uselessness of the Democratic Party and liberalism more generally. On the one hand, because the Democrats, not only did they not really fight against this bill, but they even sort of clapped, you know, when it was being approved.
Right.
Under the, you know, the assumption that this would then get them elected down the line. And so they don't care about anyone's fucking lives being destroyed. They're not really even choosing to fight hard about any of these policies that are being put forth. And that leads us to then understand similarly that the people in those town halls, the Democratic Party has no way of, you know, of bringing these people toward any kind of better politics. It has no understanding of what they're going through. It has no interest in understanding that reality. And instead, you've got this kind of shitty liberalism that mocks people for, you know, making the wrong decision and saying they deserve it. When, you know, it's not, you know, it's not the case that there's nothing funny about a Trump voter being very then, you know, frustrated, but it points toward the uselessness of the Democrats in being able to build any kind of left-wing politics. And they're not going to do it for us. So we're going to have to do that shit by ourselves.
Right, of course. Well, speaking again to the right, we kind of hinted at this earlier, but, you know, Trump is seeming more and more to kind of leave behind the more insurgent far right base. I mean, obviously he still has some supporters, but it seems like every day he does something that pushes, you know, more and more different groups of constituents that make up kind of the grassroots far right away. You know, the all right kind of said goodbye after Syria. Now there's this whole thing about him, you know, speaking mildly favorably of Islam, and people are pissed about that. But what do you see happens next for the far right, you know, post-Trump? Is there going to be kind of a period where it goes quiet, or that there's going to be something even more horrible that comes in its place? Because I think a lot of people within that crowd are looking for the next leader that will really unite them.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, as I said, this coalition was a very tense one. I mean, and the idea of bringing the far right into the political mainstream was always going to be a complicated one for Trump. And he was eventually forced to make a decision, right? He was forced to decide between the really, you know, really confronting the traditional political order, including not only the Democrats, but elements of the Republican Party and the military, you know, which was very, you know, behaving very aggressively toward him at certain points. And so, you know, he made a decision between being impeached or worse, and maintaining his faithful, his relationship with his far right base. He cut the ties to them for the most part. I mean, it's not a total break. Bannon is still around. He just doesn't have the power that he had. The bombing in Syria was, of course, a very indicative factor of a willingness to intervene in a way that means him doing essentially what Clinton would have done if she were elected. And it was him turning toward this traditional power structure. And the really dangerous part of the equation is that this far right is not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. And so those people who were like, oh, you have to vote for Clinton to stave off the far. Well, the far right wasn't going to go anywhere if Clinton was elected either. You know, that this far right movement was going to be here. You know, Trump getting elected threw a bunch of wind into their sails, raised their expectations, and now those expectations are being dashed a bit. And dashed expectations, whether it's on the right or on the left, is a really powerfully dangerous, you know, situation when it comes to things breaking out. Often revolutionary movements come out of expectations, you know, being raised and then dashed and frustrated. Black Lives Matter, for example, also emerges from the hope promised by Obama and the immediate, you know, return to the status quo of, you know, of continued black death by police. And so what's dangerous is that these movements aren't going anywhere, that they're going to try to continue to grow, that they're going to capitalize on this. You had a moment in which, you know, some of these right-wing groups and the Minutemen, for example, on the border, thought that Trump was going to do what they wanted. And so then they were scratching their heads and saying, well, what are we going to do now? Right. And now they may pull a U-turn and say, well, Trump is actually maybe not the person that we thought he was going to be. So we need to be building, you know, building us, you know, a stronger movement for ourselves. And that's, you know, honestly, that's where we step in, right, and make that impossible and fight back against that. But we also need to be very attentive to the fact that they're going to be wildly unpredictable in the coming weeks and months. And so when we're mobilizing, when we're organizing, they're going to be there, and they're going to be pushing back. We saw some of this in Berkeley and elsewhere. And, you know, at some point, all bets are off once the people are in the streets. And we need to, you know, we need to take that very seriously as we, you know, move forward in what are going to be very, very dangerous times.
Yeah. Just to get back on Trump specifically, I take it you think that he will not be impeached, that he will just continue?
I think his calculation was to not be impeached. Whether that works or not, I'm not entirely sure. But what he's done is to buy off some of those sectors that would have supported impeachment and to kind of placate them. But, you know, again, maybe those sectors will decide that they'd rather have Pence regardless. But he may be around. I didn't think he was going to make it this long. So, it's really difficult to predict what's going to happen down the road.
Right. Well, thinking about these situations like what's happening in Flint, Michigan, I think it was maybe a week ago, there's been they've granted a year for people to figure out their situation with the water liens. About 8,000 people were being threatened with foreclosure. But looking at Flint and also what's happening with the AHCA, what do you think that revolutionaries should be thinking about in these situations where they're just such major contradictions that, like, you know, things are very bad and they're going to get worse, and everybody seems to understand that for massive amounts of people. I mean, not even factoring in climate change, but I mean, just literally looking at like what's happening in Flint, or you have tens of thousands of people that are threatened with not only not being able to afford their healthcare, but possibly being kicked off it and potentially even dying. Absolutely. I mean, how do you think we should be thinking about like how this impacts our organizing, especially when you add into the fact that like we can't necessarily just, you know, it'd be great if we could walk in and occupy the hospital and run it ourselves. But I mean, there's like the critical infrastructure that I think that we would need to solve some of these problems is in the hands of corporations in the state.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a good example, right? Because in particular, and especially when the Flint stuff first blew up, I remember talking about this and saying, listen, this is a moment in which anything could happen in Flint. And people would understand the legitimacy of those actions, right? People could take over the city, shut it down, organize, you know, direct action constantly to, you know, to shut that city down and to demand better access, to demand direct control over, you know, the water supply, for example, but also the city administration. And there would be a mainstream widespread echo of the legitimacy of this movement because everyone understands the inhumanity that's going on there, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm not saying that we need to rely on the way that all of our struggles are perceived in the vast majority of the country. But I think we need to understand that this is a moment in which people understand why those things are happening, right? And understand that radical action is legitimate. For example, again, like punching Richard Spencer in the face, you could have done that a year ago and no one would have noticed or no one would have cared. And it certainly wouldn't have been on the front page of the newspapers. And yet, in the historical moment, in the situation that we found ourselves in, it was something that found resonance in the mass, in mass culture. And so that's the kind of thing I think we need to understand. Direct resistance against police violence, direct resistance against migration, you know, ICE raids, because these are kind of the two faces of the Trump fascism, right? The internal and the external face. The police endorsed Trump, and so did the Border Patrol. Because they both want to be able to do anything they want. And both of these sectors are going to actually turn out to be, I think, flashpoints as we move forward. And so we need to be able to engage in struggles against these while also building popular movements to defend, you know, communities and to establish, you know, for example, I keep talking about rapid response networks, which is something that we've been involved in organizing. to, you know, so that when the police are in a neighborhood, everyone knows about it. Everyone lets their neighbors know. And even better, you know, people build these kind of networks that make it possible to not call the police at all. Just like if ICE is rolling through a neighborhood, often with people, even on a very informal level, already be developing, you know, ways to let their neighbors know that ICE is around, and to figure out maybe where they're headed and to try to resist that, you know. And we've seen spontaneous resistance to ICE raids already. And these are the kind of things I think that we need to deepen and build as we move forward.
Right. Yeah. I mean, well, you were saying about having a residence. I remember when the occupation at the, it was the, in Chicago, I think the Republic Windows and Glass and Doors was occupied, and then had like a huge resonance with people because it was right when kind of everybody's was like finally being like, yeah, the, you know, shit sucks and it's not our fault. It's actually the fault of the system. And I think that's very important for us to be thinking about, especially right now, you know, that people are starting to be like, okay, Trump had a shot. It's still the same kind of game. It's still getting worse. And the kind of like what would bring people in. And I think, yeah, I feel like a lot of people are just kind of waiting for that next kind of Occupy or Black Lives Matter kind of moment to engulf them. But we really need to be experimenting.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, and it's important to understand the difference of being under a Trump versus being under an Obama. And that plays out in a very complicated way, right? It was under Obama that a lot of these movements, you know, emerged, right? So it wasn't simply the case. It wasn't simply the case that having a Democrat in power meant that it was harder to organize. It actually gave us kind of some space to organize. Having the Democrats in power also allows us to, you know, to rule out elections as a solution, right? You know, you say you got Obama in power, a relatively progressive, you know, for the Democratic Party standards, and things are still the same, right? Things are still not changing. Therefore, we need to fight ourselves. The opportunity under Trump is that things are obviously getting very bad and people are feeling it and people are willing to struggle and ready to throw down. And yet the danger is precisely that this will be filtered into demands for the Democratic Party to be reelected to fuck everything up again, right? And so I think we need to navigate this terrain very carefully. We need to mobilize the energy and the momentum, right? There was the momentum that greeted Trump being elected in the first place, the direct protest, which pointed towards something very interesting, which is namely the fact that people who believe in elections usually were willing to say this is an illegitimate president, right? Regardless of whether he was elected legally or anything, we need to be able to resist this president. What we need to do on the left is to not close off the possibility that the masses are going to be moving to the left and shifting to the left in the years to come. We too often, you know, make kind of purity a sign of strength, and we celebrate even our own isolation. When in reality, what we need to do is to figure out how it is and what kind of narratives will draw in huge numbers of people, anchor them in a radical politics and pull them radically to the left. That's, I think, the task that we need to engage.
Well, let's just go back to some of the other things you were talking about. I want to talk a little bit about Jeff Sessions. He's talking about bringing key aspects of the drug war. I know that you've talked a lot about the police and police murders of people of color. I mean, what do you think that we'll see with Jeff Sessions? Like, how do you think this is going to play out, and how do you think that people should be thinking about how to respond?
I mean, I think what we know we're going to see is an uptick in mass incarceration. I think a lot of us thought, or hoped at least, that we had kind of gotten over the big hump when it comes to mass incarceration, that if not abolitionist narratives, but kind of decarceration narratives about the fact that there's far too many people in prison, you know, as problematic as a lot of these narratives were, like, you know, so-called nonviolent offenders, you know, the kind of now the new sympathy for drug users, now that it's a lot of white people that are, you know, being associated with that drug use. but we, you know, we did, I think, see a sort of narrative that was pushing toward lowering the prison population. And I think that's kind of out the window very quickly. And we know precisely how it's going to play out, who's going to be targeted. And we know also that the Attorney General's office is not going to be prosecuting police when they murder, you know, black and brown people, and is not going to take any kind of aggressive stance and will prosecute our movements, right? Like, that's the flip side of it. You know, the statement that was released by the Trump White House immediately on being elected that said, "We are with the police. We stand with law enforcement against the rioters and the looters." And that was a very, very frightening statement, because it, you know, because first of all, the police already have so much fucking power and so much authority and autonomy. They can do essentially whatever they want. They can murder people with near impunity and maybe get a slap on the wrist or a couple of years. This is just the sort of sad reality of the situation. And yet here you have an administration saying that they shouldn't even get that, right? And saying that it's actually the people who protest these acts that need to be prosecuted. And if you look at what's going on with the inauguration protesters, it's clearly a portent of some really, you know, dangerous and crucial times ahead, where, you know, we're going to be fighting precisely against Jeff Sessions and everything he stands for.
Right. I'm just curious. I mean, the way the media plays this out is in terms of a culture war, as opposed to, you know, people fighting back against white supremacy or the very real class dynamics at play. How do you think, I mean, we've talked a little bit about like narratives and stuff like that, but how to get beyond this kind of narrative of, you know, there's two camps. One is in a big city and like, you know, cares about identity politics. And the other one is like some white guy in a, you know, a rural place that is angry about losing his job. And like, that's all there is. And there's a cult. It's just culture. It's just a cultural difference. I mean, how do we get beyond kind of like this very limited and ultimately kind of liberal milquetoast idea?
Mm-hmm. I mean, on the one hand, it's like I almost want to say, you know, it sounds, you know, a little corny, but the answer has to be kind of a dialectical one in which we understand, firstly, the reality of that, right? Because the Democrats, in some ways, actually want to deny that reality, even if they then embrace it in other ways. We need to understand the reality of that division. That's a division that Trump benefits from. That's a division that has very material effects in the world. But then to dismantle it and dissect it and also overcome it, you know, we dismantle it by understanding, of course, that it was not just white, you know, poor white people who were abandoned by neoliberal Democrats, right? It was all poor people, right. And, you know, particularly people of color, who find themselves in really brutally difficult class positions, that opens up a possibility for some kind of unity that needs to be built in the future. And, you know, and we need to understand that. And we also, you know, need to understand the ways in which, you know, we need to move beyond and build and develop a way of speaking about about overcoming this unity that doesn't downplay or minimize the weight of anti-Black oppression, for example, or, you know, anti-Latino oppression or, you know, indigenous genocide in this country. And this is hard work, right? This is the work of the sort of classic Rainbow Coalition of the Panthers, you know, and the Young Patriots and others, the Young Lords. And we need to, you know, figure out what we can do to rebuild these kind of conversations so that, you know, poor white people, without us embracing, again, without us saying it's okay for you to be reactionary, you know, we can brutally and straightforwardly say, you know, and attack those sentiments among poor whites while insisting simultaneously that they're being fucked by the system and that they need to be able to overcome that. They need to abandon certain elements of what they've been taught and understood that don't provide any kind of explanation for their condition, and really turn toward a much more radical politics.
Yeah. And I think maybe, you know, like you said, that's one of the key tasks of the current moment with Trump is to like, really be like, look, like, you know, they sold you on white supremacy and you got fucked, you got class war. And, because I think a lot of people like the Democrats will turn around and be like, well, yeah, Trump, you know, talked about globalism and, you know, NAFTA and all that stuff. And, you know, that got you to where you're at, you know, neoliberalism's the way that, you know, it's going to get better.
Yeah. And people don't fucking buy that. Right. And that's why they didn't for Hillary in the Rust Belt. And that's why, you know, regardless of all shortcomings, you know, Bernie Sanders very much could have won the election because you know, all these millions more votes he would have gotten. No, but he would have gotten very strategic votes away from the Trump base in certain sectors. And that's real, right? And the fact that people would vote for Sanders, that a lot of, you know, these poor, you know, working class whites would vote for a Sanders and not a Clinton is not because they're dumb, right? It's precisely because they understand that Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and the whole fucking right wing Democratic apparatus is why they are living the way that they're living. Mm-hmm. The fact that they, you know, embrace the absurdity that Trump offers as an explanation is a different question, but it doesn't mean that there isn't a sort of deep understanding. And a lot of people, and this is borne out, I think, in the polling data that shows that a lot of people voted for Trump knowing that he was wrong about a lot of these things, but also feeling like they didn't have anyone else to vote for. Right. That doesn't excuse, of course, the willingness to co-sign white supremacy. But, you know, again, we're not our task, our job is not to try to fucking excuse people. Our task is to try to figure out what can be built in the future.
Right. Well, let's talk about your book. I mean, you dropped the D word, dialectics. Your new book is Decolonizing Dialectics. What is it about, and what does that title mean exactly?
Right. So this is a book that actually began, I mean, it was my PhD dissertation, you know, starting way back. And it began before this moment of upsurge that we're living through. And I think that's key. But at the same time, I think it's grown and transformed because suddenly things were in motion. In other words, things were moving dialectically. There, you know, clashes were breaking out and conflicts, despite the sort of pronunciation of of the end of history, of neoliberal capitalism representing the final state of human existence. That's precisely what has collapsed, right? And we see, as a result, the collapse of that unity giving rise to divisions and oppositions and conflicts and clashes. And these have been very productive and often very radical. This is why we see the so-called pink tide emerge in Latin America. This is why we see what happened in the Arab Spring and in the Occupy movements and in the Indignados in Spain. And so the book attempts to grapple with what it takes, you know, what revolutionary transformation means and what kind of a dialectics, in other words, what kind of an understanding of how those oppositions and clashes and conflicts can be productive. We need to, you know, forge to think through the present. It moves through different thinkers, but really the central piece of it is to then take this understanding, a radical understanding of dialectics, and to, as I put it, decolonize it and to say, well, what would it take actually for our understanding of radical conflict and social change to be able to accommodate struggles, global, truly global struggles, right? Struggles across the world, across the so-called third world, struggles that often do not take a simple class manifestation, right? It's not a question of the formal proletariat taking power or struggling over the conditions in the workplace, precisely because there are many places in which this proletariat is a minority, a small minority, and you have a whole range of different class positions, but also racial and gender positions that play a huge role in constituting the struggles that we actually see break out, right? So we're seeing struggles led by a whole range of sectors, and yet we need to update, I think, our understanding of dialectical, you know, movement to be able to accommodate those and to be able to think through, on the one hand, change and struggle that is combative and that is frontal, that does not, you know, wait for history to move by itself, but that understands that we are the ones that move this history. And then on the other hand, to make clear that, you know, this is not simply a question of embracing a European category of, you know, of social class being the single determinant of historical motion, where you have people like Slavoj Žižek, you know, embracing what he calls a Eurocentrism and demanding that, you know, so-called identity politics be, you know, be pushed aside and embraced. And we have this resurgence today of class first politics. And that's a really powerfully negative element, I think. You know, you have class versus identity politics, but you know what? Class politics is identity politics because the working class identifies as working class and understands its role in the struggle over existing conditions, right? But you know what else? You know, people of color and formerly colonized people also exist in very real material conditions that need to be struggled against. You know, the fact that police walk down the street and can slaughter black people in the United States and not go to jail for it is a material reality that needs to be struggled against and has actually been much more productive over the past few years than straightforward struggles over over class as an isolated factor. And so what we need to do is think about class not as something separate from race, but as something deeply and radically intertwined with it and inseparable from it. And we need to think about a sort of certain kind of dialectical, approach and formulation that will allow us to grasp these struggles and to help to push them forward.
Going into the summer, it seems like people are presupposing that two things are going to happen, that there will be some like kind of popular positive movement breakout around what we don't know, but will, you know, basically be like Occupy or Black Lives Matter and kind of bring people together in the streets to kind of hold space. And also a lot of people are supposing that, especially with Sessions now kind of coming back and really trying to push the police, that there's going to be probably another round of riots. And I'm just curious if in either of those two contingencies or both, I mean, going into it, having looked back at everything that's happened under the Obama years, what should we be thinking about when those things really pop off?
I mean, we need to understand, and I think that's a totally reasonable scenario. There's been a momentary eclipse of questions of so-called Black Lives Matter, you know, organizing, and people are talking about the end of that. But you know, this shit has been going on for hundreds of years, right?
Right.
This is not going anywhere, right? None of these tensions have been resolved. They've actually just been ratcheted up, and the pressure is just growing and preparing to explode. But what we need to understand fundamentally is that those explosions are when politics begins to take place, right? It's not because people stood up, or simply because people stood up and said Black Lives Matter, that this country has been radically transformed. It's because of Ferguson. It's because of Baltimore. It's because people said enough is enough. They rejected, you know, the kind of, you know, demand that they remain, you know, calm and peaceful and tranquil and argue with their enemies, or sort of, you know, use sort of reasonable speech. And they exploded, right? And they took to the streets and they demanded it. And they forced the system to respond. And that is how change begins to happen. That's how it always begins to happen. And so part of what we need to do is to push back on those so-called voices of reason and tranquility that try to, on the one hand, demonize the oppressed when they rise up, and then try to swoop in and calm them down and really just, you know, play the role of counterinsurgents, you know, when we actually need to be building a stronger insurgency.
Well, on that note, thank you so much for joining us. Is there anything else you want to talk about, or I encourage people to check you out on Twitter? Any other thing you want to plug, or any shout outs, or any other things you have coming up that you want to talk about?
No, just shout out to the wretched of the earth as usual. But, you know, check me out on Twitter, Chick Marr. You know, I, you know, recently returned from Mexico where I was researching popular self-defense movements. And, you know, and this has informed, I think, a lot of what I've been talking about as well. And, you know, we need to be thinking, you know, across these borders. We need to be thinking in conjunction with movements, you know, in Mexico, for example, as we build these, you know, these struggles. And, you know, we need to be building in our communities. I don't think I'm saying anything that people, you know, don't know. But I think we on the left need to be, I think, a little bolder. We need to be a little less snarky. And we need to be a little more willing to, you know, to take the risks that are necessary in this moment.
I totally agree. Well, thanks so much for joining us, and we'll have to have you on again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you for listening all the way to the very, very end. Thank you, George, for coming on the show and sharing all those wonderful insights about everything that's going on in the world, everything that's happening in the United States. You know, things aren't just cut and dry. You can't just share something on Facebook and post something on Instagram. Like, there's a lot of in-depth shit we've got to really work out and think about, and also experiment. Get out there and try something. Take a risk. You know, think strategically about what we're doing. You know, this isn't just some ideology we are regurgitating out. We've got to really think about it. We've got to think about how people are going to react. We've got to think about what we're going to do, how the right is going to respond, everything. And thanks to people like George that are able to come on the show, helps give us a sense of depth and analysis that we can kind of look back on these things and think about what we're doing. And if you appreciate IGD, if you appreciate the platform that we're creating, please sign up for our new Patreon if you can. $5 goes a long way, $10, $20, whatever you can. Sign up and get rewards. Sign up to become part of the ongoing discussion on the Patreon page. We're trying to get up to $3,000 for this thing so we can actually continue and expand our platform. But thanks to everybody that's donated so far. Every day we get a new person signing up, or a couple people. Every little bit helps, and we are getting closer every single day to our goal of $3,000. So thanks for everybody. It's been really amazing to see it grow. And thanks to also everybody that's been getting t-shirts and stickers. If you have ordered stickers in the past and we've sent you an email being like, you know what, we ran out. We just got restocked thanks to our fine friends at Fresh Prints Sticker Company. So please, if you want stickers, if you want a new IGD t-shirt, now's the time. Hit us up. Let's get to it. And we got a lot more podcasts planned coming at you soon. So stay tuned. Thanks a lot.